How many of you are new? You have not been here so far this week. There are a few of you, so I will begin after our prayer with a little review and catch up, as I call it. And how many of you are leaving today? Oh, wow. There's half my class. Well, I anticipated that the Okoboji crowd were leaving. And most of you are that group,
yeah,
right?
Right.
And so I'm going to leap over and give you the punchline like I promised. Otherwise, we'd wait till tomorrow for that.
Yes, you might announce ahead of time that you're going to do that, and those that are staying would leave the room. That's right, they might not come back if they know the punchline.
Let's begin with a time of quiet and prayer. Gracious God, as we once again enter this holy arena of your word, we ask that you would give us ears that are able to hear and eyes that see. Amen. For those of you who are new to the group, this week we've been looking at the Gospel of Mark and using as not so much the basis but the inspiration for the approach that we're taking the book by Ched Myers entitled Binding the Strong Man. And I put Ched Myers' outline of Mark on a piece of paper up here. We're not following that outline very precisely. We're following a different scheme, but using much of the interpretation that Myers provides. He calls his book a political reading of Mark's story of Jesus. And I think we've already discovered, those of us who have been together for 3 days now, why he uses that term political reading. He wants us to see the Gospel of Mark as coming out of a community of people that lived in the northern part of Palestine, a rural community, who were committed to a vision which the writer of Mark sees in the teachings of Jesus. So he writes the story of Jesus in order to encourage this community to in its vision, its vision of equality for all people, its vision of revolutionizing society in such a way that all of the forces that suppress and oppress people will be eliminated, not by military action, but through nonviolence, through a revolution that comes automate, as we saw yesterday, out from the ground, not something superimposed by a violent authority. Consequently, that community is opposed to those Jewish people who would try to overcome the Roman Empire and its mighty legions, which were the army of occupation in Palestine, through military force. They oppose that point of view. They're also opposed to the temple authorities, the religious authorities down in Jerusalem, who have also in their own way oppressed people through the ancient Hebrew practices, part of which was the Levitical purity code that classified people and relegated the poor and women and infirm to a lesser place in that society. This is the vision of the Markan community, as Myers calls it. So you see, he's trying to show us that the teachings of Jesus have to do not only with our relationship to God in some vertical sense, as we think of it, or obeying the law of God that we might get to heaven, or even being a child of God through the grace of God that we might get to heaven, but it's a political reading of the gospel, that we might see how the teachings of Jesus call us as the church call us as today's Marken community into advocacy for the poor and the liberation of all people who are in oppression. That's Meyer's point of view. And most of you have heard me say this several times now, but for the new folks, that we might get that kind of perspective. And what I've been saying along the way is that I see this as a very refreshing way to look at the gospel. It's not the way in which most of us have been schooled over the years, but it helps to give us a different dimension, perhaps, to our reading of Mark. And I've suggested that I don't present this to you as the way to read the Gospel of Mark, but rather as a way to read it, so that in the future, when you read the Gospel again and again and again, as I know you will do, it will be part of the grist for the mill as you interpret this marvelous little book, this tract, as I think of it, that comes out of the ancient world, the oldest of the four Gospels, the first story of the sayings and actions of Jesus. Now, we're behind schedule, as we always are when I teach. last time we were going to deal with the section in Mark that I'm calling On the Way, and it's what Myers refers to as a subsection at the very beginning of book two, the second half of this book. And we're calling it On the Way because it begins, if you have your Bibles, at chapter 8, verse 27, where you'll see the expression on the way, and takes us to the end of chapter 10, where once again, at the end of that chapter, you have the words on the way. Note the places in that section, 8:27 through chapter 10. The places are, if I can draw my little Sunday school map of Palestine again, Sea of Galilee about here, Jordan River about here, Dead Sea down this way, Jerusalem sits about here, Jericho about here, Capernaum's about here, Caesarea Philippi's up here, Bethsaida's over here. Those are the names that we have. Chapter 8, verse 27 starts with Caesarea Philippi. Now notice in the second book, as I said before, the emphasis is upon Jesus teaching his closest followers, what we think of as the disciples. But that means not just the 12. It's a larger group. There's some women among them, apparently. We don't know how. But while in the first group, he's working with crowds of people, masses, as I like to say. In the second book, you have very little reference to crowds, or some. But almost all of it is a tutorial private teaching with this inner group who are now being prepared to be the leaders of the new community that will issue from Jesus' ministry. Well, he takes that small group way to the north, Caesarea Philippi. Then when you get to chapter 9, verse 30, we're told they're passing through Galilee, the northern part. The northern part of Palestine was known as Galilee. Middle part was known as what? Samaria. The lower part was known as Judea. We get the word Jew from that word, Judea. So they're going through Galilee in chapter 9, verse 30. At verse 33, they're back to Capernaum again, where they've been now for some time. And then, beginning with chapter 10, they're going through the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan. Beyond always means east bank. The Bible, the story is told from the perspective of what we now think of as the West Bank, the west side of the Jordan River. And when you get to chapter 10, verse 32, going up to Jerusalem. Now we're let in on the destination. the capital city, where the temple is located, in Jerusalem. And then in the verse 46, they're in Jericho, which is a city close to Jerusalem. So the whole story has moved now from up here, rural Palestine, down into the center, the urban center of that nation. And that's, of course, where the great climactic events are going to take place. We know that from our previous Bible study. Myers sees the story of the blind man in chapter 8, go back to that verse 22 and following, as a transition between book 1 and book 2. One of the ongoing themes, and it becomes even a more important theme as we get into book 2, is the eyes that don't see and the ears that don't hear. Constantly telling people to wake up, his own crowd, his own inner circle. Wake up, don't you get it? Listen, pay attention. The parable of the sower we looked at yesterday. The key idea is, listen, can't you hear? Don't you get it? And the problem is that because of entrenched points of view that these good, faithful Jewish people had, they were unable to get the new message that was coming through, the radical message that was coming through from Jesus. And what we're seeing in these chapters in the On the Way story is a growing alienation between Jesus and his own inner circle. The disciples are more and more perplexed, more and more unsure about this guy, and more troubled, and we find them gradually more and more drifting away. And we see that immediately in what Myers calls the confessional crisis that takes place. In chapter 9, chapter 8, when they go up into Caesarea Philippi, we have this familiar story where Jesus asks the disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And what happens? Simon Peter, the talkative one, the extrovert among the disciples, gives the answer, and what's the answer? You are the Christ. Now, let's remember, read of you again, this word Christ, what does it mean?
Messiah.
It's the same thing as the word Messiah. This is the Hebrew word, this is the Greek word. It's the same word. And what's the word mean? Someone who has been
anointed.
Someone who's had motor oil poured over his head. The image is that of the coronation of a king. So Christ, Messiah, always implies royalty, kingliness. Peter says, you are the Messiah. And the Hebrew people have for generations, for centuries, been anticipating the coming of the Messiah. And before the Messiah comes, who will come? Elijah will come. And we saw earlier in the first chapter that John the Baptist is immediately associated with Elijah. So we have John the Baptist, the Elijah coming, preparing the way for the coming of the royal one, the king. Peter got that. He understood that. And Jesus says, in effect, you go to the head of the class, Peter. You've caught on. However, then he says, what does Jesus say?
Don't tell anyone.
And then he goes on to say, I'm going to be killed. That doesn't fit. That's not a part of this picture at all in Peter's mind. That can't be. So Peter says, no way, no way. And Jesus' response to him is, sorry, Peter, I thought you got it, but you didn't get it. You haven't understood. Peter goes to the top of the class, and then he goes to the bottom of the class. What's going on here is a redefinition of this whole history, this centuries-long Hebrew tradition of Messiahship. They were expecting a king who would overthrow Rome, set up a kingdom in Jerusalem. What kind of king? I know your Old Testament history. The king, who were the great kings? The history of Israel. David. Glorious empire at the time of David. And his son
Solomon.
Oh, marvelous empire. Rule that whole Middle East area. If you look in your Bible maps, you see the kingdom of David was a huge area, far beyond this little area here. Oh, we're coming into our own again when the Messiah comes. And Jesus says he's going to be killed. How does that fit the picture? That's impossible. That can't be. There's no way. Peter just can't understand that at all. Myers calls that a confessional crisis. That's a pretty good term for that. Mm-hmm. And then you move into the next story is the story of the Transfiguration that we celebrate in our church calendar every year. I always find that text is one of the hardest texts of all to preach on. I never quite know what to say about the Transfiguration. And once again, Jesus takes the three of the disciples, the closest ones, with him up to this mountain, and this amazing experience happens where he's transfigured. And Peter, what does Peter want to do? He wants to stay there. Hey, this is great. We're at Holden Village. We don't want to go home. We don't want to stay on the mountaintop, huh? I don't go back there and deal with all the kids and stuff I got to deal with, my job and everything, the mundane stuff of life. He wants to stay up there. We're going to build these booths, these displays up here. We're going to live up here. Again, Jesus says, no, that's not the way it is. And you still are. Peter's got a triumphalist theology, you know, that sees the way God's working in the world is leading us to some great, majestic, marvelous, whatever it is. And Jesus has to take him down off the mountain. Down, not up, but down. Oh, imagine how disappointed Peter must have been and how puzzled he must have been. What's this all about? I don't understand any of this. Have you ever had some teachers you didn't understand? Peter could not understand Professor Jesus at this point at all. He was talking gobbledygook, couldn't figure it out. Then to skip down to chapter 9, verse 33, these disciples have an argument as they're going, quote, on the way. And what are they arguing about? Well, after Jesus, the Messiah, comes into his kingdom, they still have in their heads that he's going to be a king. Which of us is going to be prime minister and secretary of state? And, you know, who will get to sleep in the bedroom in the White House? And, you know, who will be the greatest? And who will be the least? They still got a hierarchical, top-down understanding of things, and they still haven't got it. They still haven't understood. This whole notion of egalitarianism or equality, which this little community is committed to, the mission, the vision that Jesus is teaching, they haven't understood it. And you have the theme that runs through the Gospel of Mark so beautifully illustrated, the last shall be first and the first shall be last. I mean, if you're going to stack them up, you want to be here because that's the people who will be here. Like I said, the first day, we people in South Dakota like that because we're always relegated to the last by the Minnesotans. So we'll be first someday. It's all right. Minnesota will have to go into decline at some point in time. Now I live in Minnesota, and I'm not sure I want that to happen either. Then when you get to chapter 10, verse 35 and following, you've got James and John, the sons of Zebedee, two of the closest of Jesus' companions, Peter, James, and John. And they get into this crazy notion. Jesus, when you become king, how would it be if one of us sits on your right hand and the other sits on your left hand when you come in your glory? I mean, they really wanted to be a part of the inner group. And Jesus says, can you be baptized with what I will be baptized? Oh, sure. They didn't understand when he said baptized, he meant killed, crucified. And then he said, you will indeed be baptized with what I'm baptized. And what's the image on Calvary? One cross, three crosses. There is a person on the right hand and on the left hand. Huh? Think of the irony of that. But it's not James and John who are on those crosses, it's a couple of bandits. It's a couple of those zealots who are trying through military power to overthrow the Roman Empire. They're the ones that get up there on the right hand and the left side of the king when he comes into his glory. Who wants that kind of glory? So they still haven't understood. And what Myers is saying is, through this story, we're seeing more and more alienation between Jesus and his closest followers. Part of the tragedy and the irony of this story. And then Jesus illustrates for them, I don't want to pass over that, let the little children come unto me, because that's a first, last, first, beautiful thing. Illustrates that whole point that we're talking about, doesn't it? That the children who were, everybody said, get the kids out of the way. Jesus said, bring them in. Again, remember, our community is committed to equality for adults and children. Children were often put aside, nuisance kind of people. Then Jesus is laying out for them what it is they are called to. Not kingliness, not prime minister, not the White House, but those who would come after me, let them, what? Take up their cross and follow me. Oh, the cross. The cross in the ancient world was the most fearsome, awesome thing. The Roman Empire used crucifixion as the capital punishment for criminals. Crosses were identified with the worst riffraff of society and the most horrible kind of death, to be nailed to this barren tree with your arms outstretched and hang in the hot sun till you're dehydrated and the blood is drained from your body. Be merciful if you could die. And these crosses were all over. They were standing along the roadside as kind of a warning to people. We look upon capital punishment today as a deterrent to crime, but they're telling us capital punishment is not a deterrent to crime. Those states that still execute people, Minnesota does not, I'm very happy to say. We have no capital punishment law in Minnesota. And we don't have any more crime than Texas does, and they execute people all the time. Anybody here from Texas? I'm sorry if I said that. I offended you, but Texas has more executions of criminals than any other state in the United States. Their crime level is just as high as ours in Minnesota. That's not a deterrent. But we think of capital punishment as a deterrent. That's going to keep the kids from getting into crime. It doesn't work. It doesn't do that. That was the cross. Somebody suggested that if we lived in the ancient world, instead of having that beautiful gold cross around your neck on a chain, you'd have an electric chair on a cross. Or you might have a syringe with poison in it, that where you inject poison into the body of the person. You put that little syringe on your beautiful gold syringe on your then we begin to feel the power and the emotion that surrounded that notion of cross. So when Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me, ooh, it was ugly, it was terrible. Much more so than I think that statement hits us with. We've sort of lived with the notion of bearing a cross as suffering and maybe even martyrdom. I mean, we accept that notion, or some blessed are those who are persecuted kind of thing in the Sermon on the Mount. But cross was ugly, terrible, terrible physical agony for those people, and they knew that. That's what the disciples are being called to, not this glorious vision of being a part of the inner circle of a kingdom at all. And you can see how Jesus is turning this whole concept upside down. The radical approach he takes to the Hebrew understanding of Messiah. Well, so much for on the way. You want to say anything about that? Any questions? I'm skipping over a lot of good stuff in here. We have to. Well, then we come to what is supposed to be the title for today. I just call it Showdown in Jerusalem. Begins with the end of chapter 10. There are two events which Meyer sees as a kind of couplet leading into the most dramatic part of the gospel story, the last 7 days of Jesus' life. Notice that about a third of the gospel account is given over to only 7 days. The first event in that couplet is the blind Bartimaeus, who, when he calls out to Jesus, what does he call him? Do you notice that? Jesus?
Son of David.
Son of David. What does that mean, son of David?
King.
Heir to David's throne, right? He's seeing David, he's seeing Jesus in the old-fashioned traditional Messiah way. And then with the second event in that couplet is the event that we celebrate on Palm Sunday, when the people see Jesus coming on a little donkey. What do they call out? Blessed, what is the coming?
The name of the Lord.
The king. Of our
coming
ancestor king. David. Yeah. Again, you have this royalty image, and what the strange irony is that instead of Jesus coming into Jerusalem, the capital city, on a big horse, on a steed like a victorious general would, you always see these generals up on big horses. We were in Prague this summer, and here's the good King Wenceslas in Wenceslas Square, way up there on this high podium on this big horse. and so many of our statues in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere portray heroes on a horse. Here comes Jesus on a miserable little burro. If he was a tall man, his feet were dragging on the dust. He's turning this Messiah thing around. The irony of that is there. This is a portrayal, it's kind of a caricature of what Messiah is supposed to be all about. Now, Myers has a very interesting interpretation of that event. We usually think of it as Jesus coming to the gate of the city of Jerusalem, and then all these people sort of recognize him, and they come running out, and they throw palm branches, and Hosanna, Hosanna, the King of David. That's how we think of it. That, if you go to Spearfish, South Dakota, and you go to the Passion Play, that's how it is. It's all people shouting, hey, hey, hey. Myers doesn't believe that's the way it happened at all. He thinks this whole thing is staged. He notices that while the word crowds, masses, is used 38 times in the Gospel of Mark, most of them in the first book, that word is not used in this story. They're not crowds. There are a few people in this story. And he thinks that Jesus is taking his inner group that he's working with now in the second half of the gospel, and he's staging them to follow him in this way, in a way such as to turn Messiahship upside down in the eyes of the people who might observe this. That it wasn't a spontaneous thing at all, as we usually think of it. I had somebody ask when I taught this before, well, what do the other gospels say? Well, you go to Matthew says crowds. So let's think of the Passion Play as being based on Matthew. And Myers says the Passion Play is not based on Mark. It's not that way in the Gospel of Mark. Let me just read a little bit here. He points out that the stuff that's cast in front of Jesus is what does Mark say that is? It's not palms. What is it? What do they put in on the road?
Leafy branches.
From the fields. Yeah, from the fields. These are not urban Jerusalem people. They're from the fields up north. These are rural people. And where would people in Jerusalem get stuff from the fields? That's a rural image. That's one of the things that supports his argument that this is set up by these rural people in order to make a point with the onlookers. I had a quote here. Obviously, this is Myers now. Obviously, Mark is making a big production out of the fact that this procession will meet the requirements of another quite contrary part of the Zechariah tradition, which says the Messiah who comes to Zion meek, riding upon an ass. That's he thinks is a piece of Zechariah that's always been puzzling because it doesn't fit the usual picture of Messiah. And then he says, the parade is full of conflictive signals, as if it intends to be a satire on military liberators, quote unquote. Well, grist for your mill. Think about it. That's an interesting interpretation. And then he notices that when that Jesus really doesn't enter Jerusalem. Look at that in your text. We call this the entrance into Jerusalem, but he really doesn't go in there. At least he doesn't do anything. He goes inside, and what happens? Nothing happens. He goes in, kind of looks around, and leaves. Well, you'd think if he was going to be, coming in and something would happen at the end of this majestic entrance, but nothing happens. So what happens is they leave and go back to Bethany, close by. During this week, he stays overnight in Bethany. He doesn't stay in Jerusalem. The next day, he makes his second entrance into Jerusalem. This is the time when he drives out the money changers in the temple. And the chief priests and the scribes are looking for a way to kill him, but they are afraid of the masses. They're afraid of a public uprising if they do, because those masses of people are spellbound by Jesus' teaching. And Jesus attacks the temple. Now, the Hebrew people expected that the Messiah would come and protect the temple, elevate the temple. But Jesus attacks the temple. That's pretty serious. What is it that the Jewish people believed about the temple? Why was the temple so important? Do you remember that from Sunday school?
The Ark of the Covenant was there.
The Ark of the Covenant was in the temple. And what was the Ark of the Covenant?
The presence of God.
The Ark of the Covenant was a little box.
Contained the tablets.
Contained the tablets of stone.
It was God's presence, kind of.
Pardon me?
It was kind of a visualization of God's presence.
Yeah. They associated the Ark of the Covenant with God's very presence. God is here. God lived in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, in a place where nobody ever entered except the high priest once a year, only once. In the outer area of the temple, people would come, the high priest would go in, and the Ark of the Covenant. God lives in the temple. The temple is the very presence of God. Notice the architecture of our churches usually are based on this. The altar being the ark. In traditional liturgy, when the pastor stands in front of the altar and faces the congregation, sometimes the pastor will face the congregation. Sometimes the pastor does a very rude thing, turns around with his or her back to the congregation. Why? What's the difference between the two? Pardon me?
Addressing God.
During times of prayer, the pastor faces the altar, which is the God, the presence of God, and speaks to God on behalf of the people. That's a priestly function. Then when the pastor turns with his or her back to the altar and faces the people, what's the pastor doing? Speaking on behalf of God to the people. That's a prophetic function. So in the liturgy on Sunday morning, the pastor plays both a priestly and a prophetic function. The symbolized by the altar as the very presence of God. And that's borrowed from the ancient Hebrew temple, that architecture, that understanding, that liturgical meaning. So to attack the temple was seen by the people as attacking God. And what Meyer suggests is that Jesus is trying to teach a distinction here, to say that attacking the temple is quite different than attacking God. He sees the temple as getting in the way of the things of God because of what the temple has come to represent. The temple was a part of the economic oppression of the people and represented that purity code, that whole symbol of injustice that was borrowed from ancient times. He points out that there are two different groups of people that Jesus attack in the temple. Who are they? Do you notice? There are the money changers and the people who were selling doves. Now, he says, the money changers were notoriously crooked. If you go to a foreign country and you get some money changed, you know that some places give you a better dollar value than other places do. Some places charge you as much as 20-25% commission to change your money. And another place will charge you, we discovered in Prague, we could get some places with 2% commission. The money changers in the temple were pocketing a good deal of what the changing that was happening. And Myers points says that the people that bought turtle doves were the poor people. The rich people had their own much more grand sacrifice to bring, like a lamb or a goat or something. But the poor people didn't have that. So they'd come, and with their little bit of money, they'd buy little doves and make that as their sacrifice. So what Myers is seeing is Jesus' attack is directly upon those who were oppressive of the poor and were part of that whole commercial stuff that the temple was into. So the temple had become not only a religious center, but it had become a commercial center. So the temple had to go. And he said that to the disciples. Remember that one place that's in here where the disciples say, oh, what a magnificent place this is. Just look at this building. And it was. It's grand, wonderful. It's like looking at the Empire State Building the first time. Oh, gee. Or going to St. Vitus Cathedral in Prague. Oh, man, beautiful, beautiful place. Rose window. And Jesus said, in 3 days it'll be gone. So I'll just tear the whole thing down. What? You're the Messiah. You can't do that. Messiah is supposed to be on the side of the temple. Jesus is teaching a distinction between God and the temple. And he even stops all the temple traffic in the process, so the people can't even go in and out of the temple. What a spoil sport, this guy. Myers thinks that in 11:23, when Jesus says, if you have faith enough to move mountains, he's talking about the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. That's an interesting idea. I never thought of that before. So that's all part of the picture of the temple removed. Well, now I'm getting anxious about the end of the hour showing up before I'm going to be ready for it. I'm going to skip over the third entrance into Jerusalem for now. We'll get to this tomorrow. And his encounter. This is part of the shootout in Jerusalem. No, showdown in Jerusalem. And the sermon in chapter 13, we'll get back to that tomorrow for those of you who are here. But what I'd like to do is take you into chapter 14, and there we have first the story of the woman who comes and anoints Jesus. Don't lose sight of this concept of Messiah. This is the anointed one. That's back in the story. The woman comes and anoints Jesus on the head. Messiah. And how does Jesus interpret what she's done? You've got all this stuff about wasting all this wonderful ointment. He's frugal, a Walmart kind of disciples are worried about not being frugal enough. And how does Jesus interpret the anointment?
Burial.
Preparing his body for burial. Doesn't that make you choke up a little bit? She's not getting me ready for glory. She's getting me ready for death. And then the second big event in chapter 14 is the Passover Supper. which we understand as the origin of our sacrament of the Eucharist on the Lord's Supper, which I will not go into in detail now. Well, maybe I should. Let me just give you this. Myers is interested in the fact that this Passover supper, as it's described, is not at all like the Seder meal that Jewish people celebrate. Because something that was at the very center of the Jewish Passover meal is missing. Anybody have an idea what's missing in that description? Do you remember the Passover story? It comes out of... That's true. We don't have the, well, we don't know that.
We don't know that. Doesn't work
But...
Doesn't have a lamb.
They didn't have a lamb. That's the urgent thing, says Myers. The lamb was central to the Passover. And there's no lamb in Jesus' celebration with the disciples. So what Myers thinks is that, again, Jesus is providing some alternative ways of looking at this ancient tradition out of Hebrew lore. The Passover event, the Exodus event, is right smack dab in the middle of Jewish life. It is for Jewish people what the cross is for Christians. The story of their people having been liberated from Egypt, from slavery in Egypt. And you remember that part of that was the 10 plagues. The frogs, Judy. we've talked about this. Why should the frogs be associated with a plague? These frogs were kind of unruly. I mean, they just kind of got in your bed and your bathtub and all over the place. And all the water turned to blood. Remember this? And then the last plague was when the oldest son in every household was to be killed. But the, I'm sure this is repeating from all of you, but the Israelites were told to mark the door of their house with the blood of a lamb. And they were to mark, I don't know if this has been pointed out to you before, they were to mark the door and the lintel of the door with blood. There's to be blood here, and blood here, and blood here. Does that suggest anything to you? Suggest the cross. That's a good Christian way of looking at it. It's not a Jewish way of looking at it. And then when the angel of death came along to kill the firstborn son of every family, the angel would, here's the word, pass over that house, and that child would be saved. So here's a picture of saving, a saving picture, a salvation picture. And you remember and then they were told to eat, have unleavened bread, to have all their suitcases packed. You're going home from Holton Village, you got luggage, it's all packed, you're all ready to go, because at the end of that plague, Pharaoh is going, not only going to permit you to leave, he's going to say, get out of here, I've had it with you folks. And they're going to take off. And that's the exodus, the leaving. Okay, that's the big event back in Passover. We are all familiar with that. The very center of Jewish religion, the remembering the Passover is all over the Old Testament. It's in the Psalms. When you read the Psalms, notice how many times there's reference made to the Exodus. The great holy event. The great indication that God was indeed their God. The fulfillment of the covenant promise that goes all the way back to Abraham in Hebrews. But what's missing in this Passover event is there's no lamb. Who was the lamb?
Jesus
was the lamb. They didn't need a lamb. Get choked up again a little bit. Once more, an image of Jesus, not as a king on a throne, but as the one who was sacrificed, the one who was to die. His blood was to cover and make possible saving. That's all the imagery, rich, rich imagery around this event. And a revolutionary idea, says Myers, revolutionary idea. Now, Myers says Jesus is not at all, after all, participating in the temple-centered feast of Passover. Instead, he is expropriating its symbolic discourse in order to narrate his new myth. Don't be thrown by the word myth. We think of myth as being untrue. Myth is a story that has great meaning. That's what a myth is, right? True or untrue, it's a story of meaning. Instead, he is expropriating its symbolic discourse in order to narrate his new myth, that of the human one. That's what we often translate son of man. That of the son of man who gives his life for the people. And then after that event, he immediately announces that he's going to fast. So this Passover is not backward looking like the Hebrew Passover was, but it's forward looking into what is about to take place very shortly. And then he's telling the disciples, you're all going to desert me. That bond is fragmenting. And then they go to Gethsemane. But Gethsemane is tomorrow. But what I wanted you to see is at the end of that Passover event, and now I hope I have this down so I can find it quickly, because this leads us into the punchline. Oh, if I can't find the punchline. He's talking to Peter. Peter's going to deny him, right? Where are we? Chapter 14. Verse 26. When they had sung the hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives, and Jesus said to them, you will all become deserters, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I am raised up, I will go before you. Where?
Galilee.
We're going back to Galilee. We're going back to Galilee. I'm going to stay in Jerusalem. I'm going to meet you up in Galilee. Now, turn with me to the end of the story. Chapter 16. Did we point out before? Did you note before? That I think in all of your Bibles, there are different endings to the Gospel of Mark.
A shorter ending.
You have a short ending and a longer ending. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the footnotes, if you have a study Bible like mine, it'll tell you that the oldest manuscripts of this Gospel end with verse 8. But some manuscripts from the ancient world include that short edition, and some include that longer edition, and some include both of those editions. So we really don't know what the original Mark was, though my Bible says that there are very important linguistic differences between these endings and Mark itself. Myers believes, see, the problem is it ends so abruptly. So the thought is that some people haven't been happy that it ends so abruptly, and so they've added a little piece to make it come out right. And, pardon me?
That's not fair.
Well, no. Myers thinks the gospel ended with verse 8. And he doesn't think that's inappropriate at all when you look at it. This is what I think is exciting about the punchline. Notice what's happened is Jesus, or the women come to the tomb, right? Easter Sunday morning. And they meet this young man who's sitting in a white robe, who's sitting on the right side. I'm back at verse 5 now. They're alarmed. But he said to them, don't be alarmed. You're looking for Jesus of Nazareth who was crucified. He's been raised. He's not here. Look, here's the place they laid him. And then he tells the women to do something. What are they to do? Go and tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you where?
Galilee.
Galilee. And there you will see him just as he told you. So they went out, they fled from the tomb for terror and amazement. It seized them, and they said nothing, for they were afraid.
Do we know what they were afraid of?
I would say the whole blooming setup. I think it's pretty scary. But what Myers sees here is that the story begins in Galilee, and now they're going back to Galilee, and that's where the community will continue, and that's the community that Mark is now a part of, that he's been writing to, because the disciples went back to Galilee, and the story is starting all over again. Jesus' story becomes Mark's story, community story, which then becomes our story, because we are that community today that Mark is writing to. That community that has a vision of a new possible world, a better world, nonviolent world, where all oppression will be eliminated, where people will live together in peace and in justice, not trampling on each other as we're so prone to do, but to find a new way to structure our living together. A political reading of the Gospel of Mark. The five Gospels that the Jesus Seminar published has some very interesting translations. I just thought this one was kind of fun. That last paragraph. And once they got outside, they, the women, ran away from the tomb because great fear and excitement got the better of them. And they didn't breathe a word to anyone. Talk about terrified. That's how the Gospel of Mark ends. Talk about terrified. That's neat. Well, let's read a little Leonard Boff to conclude. Leonardo Boff. Last time I forgot to bring Leonardo with me, so we didn't get to hear from him. This is our parting word for those of you who are leaving tomorrow. The justice of God, which will pass judgment on human justice, will reveal itself with the brightness of sunshine on the day of the resurrection, but not right now. Now Jesus must drink the chalice of suffering down to the last drop. He must walk the way of the cross to the very end, enduring the limitless atrocities of injustice against the innocent. The penalty of the cross was the most barbaric and terrible punishment of the ancient world. It was inflicted on political rebels and slaves. The Jews regarded it as God's curse. After being tortured, people condemned to crucifixion had to carry the instrument of their own execution through the streets until they reached the place of execution outside the city. Jesus did just that until he reached the place of execution outside the walls of Jerusalem. But it was not only then that Jesus began to carry his cross. A cross is not just a piece of wood. It is everything that makes life difficult, the crosses we have to bear in life. It is everything that causes us suffering, particularly in our efforts to be just and to create more fraternal social relationships. That is carrying our cross day by day. Jesus uncomplainingly carried the crosses of his life as a poor person and an itinerant prophet. He accepted not only the tormenting limitations of a spirit in the flesh, but also the contradictions of a God made flesh in a sinful world. In a calm and courageous way, he put up with the machinations of the scribes, the opposition of the Pharisees, and the lack of understanding among his own disciples. He endured the great temptation in the Garden of Gethsemane with sweat and blood. Now he does not simply accept the cross that is imposed on him by the Jews and the Romans. He embraces the cross freely out of love. He transforms the cross from a symbol of condemnation into a sacrament of liberation.